This program is brought to you by Juul, sous vide by Chef Steps. Juul takes the guesswork out of cooking. Learn more at chefsteps.com/joule.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On today's episode, we have Katie Parla, all the way from Rome, when she was spending time in New York, here to talk to us about how she became everyone's favorite guide to the ancient city and what tips for do's and don'ts when you're traveling there for the first time or for the 10th time. And later on, we have Erica Spang back in studio with her new EP, Scars, who talks us how producer Homer sold her on her own mistakes. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz, sitting with Katie Parla, who is making a U.S. tour.
Sure.
Yeah, East Coast, West Coast.
Bicoastal.
You just came in from L.A.
Correct.
What were you doing out there?
I was working on a book with Chef Evan Funky, his forthcoming pasta book, which is going to be delicious. And so we wrote it in the beautiful California sun, and it was delightful.
And this is like your millionth book?
2 millionth.
2 millionth
I'm
book.
I'm so tired, Greg.
For anyone who doesn't know who you are, and we're going to go back and get some context, but in a word or sentence or two, I have my own impression, but I want to hear it from you first.
I'm a Rome-based food and beverage educator, cookbook author, and journalist.
Yes, I would also say that you are the go-to
wrong person for everyone in the food industry.
Oh, thank you. That's so nice.
Everyone's like, do you know Katie Parla? It's like, no, but now I do.
You do now.
I do now. But everyone was just like, you should reach out to this person. It's like, oh, okay.
I love that.
Yeah.
Because people sometimes hesitate to reach out and be like, oh, like, I'm sure you get a lot of requests. Please reach out to me. There's nothing I like more than micromanaging your caloric intake.
I want to get to that. But first, I want to go back because you're a Jersey girl.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
As many people would notice, you don't have an Italian accent.
Well, I can turn on the Jersey accent if you want to.
give me your best, like, shore. Like, let's go to the shore and go to the boardwalk.
Well, why don't we just, like, phone home and get some water? Like, oh. I'm from closer to Philly, so.
Yes, I was going to say. we'll figure it out. I didn't know that I had a Philly accent until I left Philly.
Oh, my God. Is it such a shock?
It was such a shock because it's really subtle.
Yeah.
But it's, like, very pronounced on certain words.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's my favorite regional accent, actually, so.
You might be the first and last person to, they've got a Philadelphia accent. I'm head over heels. But you got an art history degree.
Yeah.
So that began your journey, and you are wildly educated, and I want to touch on them, but where did the art history interest come from, and how did you make it all the way to Yale from mm-hmm. Jersey?
Well, I was really, really interested in, like, history in general, and I was also, like, incredibly studious. So in high school, I spent my summers studying art history at Rutgers. That's the Jersey accent.
As one
Some
does.
Would say Rutgers.
I've never heard that, but also, I'm too close to you.
So, yeah, like, I just would take all of these, like, art history surveys at Rutgers during the summer just, like, for fun because I was a nerd. Not in a pejorative sense, but I loved memorizing slides. Like, I'm very good at memorizing dates and stuff. And I thought, like, oh, this is cool. Maybe I'll continue doing this at college. And, yeah, I mean, I ended up at Yale because I studied a lot and, like, you know, did all the things you have to do to go to that type of school.
Did food factor into your family? And do you have mm-hmm. an Italian background?
Yeah, my family's Italian-American from Basilicata and Sicily. My dad has a restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey called Clyde's. And I grew up in the business. My parents met in the business. So I've always really been obsessed with food and especially interested in hospitality and, like, everything that is front of house.
What were some of the childhood specialties that have been carried down through the generations?
I mean, there is really a huge difference between what we ate at home and, like, what I would eat in, you know, my dad's restaurant. His place is a wild game restaurant. We don't have much, like, you know, bison or elk on the table at home. But yeah, lots of, like, Italian-American dishes, the sort of ubiquitous brujol, which I think every tri-stater grew up on, especially for Sunday lunch.
How did your dad land on wild game as a focus? And how wild are we talking?
So, I mean, everything from, like, the sort of run-of-the-mill bison to the more exotic lion ravioli or rattlesnake chili. There are actually, like, a lot of wild game purveyors in, like, the New York area and in Texas. So you can get, like, a lot of pretty cool stuff. And I think antelope is one of my favorite leaner meats.
What does lion ravioli taste like?
Like chicken ravioli. Oh, JK, I've never had chicken ravioli, but I imagine that's what it would taste like.
I just had a terrible, like, image of, like, a little mane around the ravioli or, like, dyed brown.
No, that's how it's served. No, of course not. I'm just kidding.
My heart just dropped. Was it hard for him to convince people to get their wild on, or was it just...
No, I mean, I think in New Brunswick, especially when his place opened in the 90s, there was a big hunger for, like, you know, fine dining, but not, like, super pretentious and stuff that was creative and interesting and really novel. And yeah, so, like, he'd been in the business at that time for, like, you know, 4 decades. So he knew what people wanted and what was sort of missing. And that's, I think, what led him to land on wild game of all things.
Of all things. So from your art history degree, you got a master's degree in Italy.
Yeah.
How did you end up over there, and what was the focus of the... And I'm not even going to attempt to say the university's name, but I'm going to have you tell me.
I will happily pronounce it for you. Yeah, so I moved to Italy because I really was obsessed with Italy and wanted to live in Rome in particular, and I didn't know that you could have, like, a career in food that was outside of, like, a restaurant or hotel, so when I saw this ad, this was, like, also 4 years after moving. I'd already done, like, a sommelier certification course and was very interested in, like, food and curating people's experiences. So I saw...
What was it about Rome that drew you out of all the other cities?
It was, like, a shitty, decaying, like, garbage-filled metropolis that was also like a movie set and stunningly beautiful in certain areas. And I like really sweat Urban Decay pretty hard. So Rome was perfect for me.
You're like, Detroit wasn't for me, so I'm going to Rome.
Exactly. Although I am going to go to Detroit next year for the first time. And I'm like very excited to visit that city. I think there's a lot of cool stuff going on. I think it's going to be like a spot that I really like. But yeah, when I was like in Rome after 4 years and just doing like a lot of wine stuff, I saw an ad for Italian gastronomic culture degree at the Università degli Studi di Roma Tor Vergata and enrolled and like studied food history. And that really like that solidified the idea that I could have a role in the food world that wasn't necessarily like rooted in a traditional restaurant or hospitality job.
And what was it? I mean, you had your SOM certification as well. What was it that felt that you couldn't do your best work or didn't draw you into the traditional restaurant business given, you know, your father's pedigree?
Well, the thing that sort of has dominated my life for the past like 2 decades, because I've been in Rome for 15 years, but decided to move there when I was in high school, like after my first trip, I always wanted to live in Rome. Like that was it for me. And that was more important than getting into the business here. And I knew that I didn't want a restaurant job in Rome because I enjoy like, you know, dignity, upward mobility in terms of like employment. I don't enjoy sexual harassment that much. I don't think many people do. And also like being a foreign woman in any industry in Italy, is really, really challenging. And I am not a diplomatic person. I don't stand for bullshit. So I probably wouldn't have excelled in that sector.
That you like day 3, fired. Day 2,
yeah.
Fired.
Yeah.
Maybe you make it to week 7. Fired.
Maybe. Yeah. Like I do things on my terms and like sometimes that doesn't work in traditional settings.
So for the master's degree, how long was it and what did you take away from it and where did they start the education? There's, I mean, millennium of information.
Well, you know, the master's programs in Italy tend to all be about a year. So it was a year long and it was sort of broken up into different units, like some focused on like nutrition and others on, you know, pasta shapes and sauces. What I took away from it is that there was this like huge category of food and food culture and that I was like very, you know, I was being exposed to a lot of different topics that I saw as potentially like useful to share with Anglophones. So although maybe I wasn't certain that I was going to go into writing when I was taking the master's program, I did know that like what I was learning could be really helpful to people, but was made up of information that wasn't available in English.
Mm. Was this information just almost accepted or really known by Italians? Like they just kind of knew the general history, or was this information you were uncovering that you were educating fellow Italians?
A lot of the coursework and the reading was based on stuff that was so like highly specialized that most Italians wouldn't have any knowledge of it. And a lot of the like academic writings are funded by universities and come out, you know, in sort of dribs and drabs and aren't necessarily widely available. A lot of the academic presses, don't really reach a wide audience. So there was all of this research and a lot of documentation that I was absorbing that just like literally wasn't available. Certainly not online, maybe available in some of the national libraries, but you would have to go really look for it. So that like really opened my eyes to this huge wealth of research and knowledge that was out there already documented, but just you had to go look for it.
Right. Like it was there, but no one had pulled it together specifically through a lens of both education and discovery.
Totally.
What was the funnest fact that you still remember from it?
That's a great question. I remember Oretta Zanini De Vita. She's the author of this like incredible encyclopedia of pasta. She talked a lot about these like obscure Sardinian pasta shapes that I had never seen nor heard of. So that was really cool. Like another reinforcement that Italian pasta alone is like an infinite topic that you can dedicate your life to and never really scratch the surface.
What constitutes an obscure pasta shape?
A pasta shape that might be made for just a single holiday or is part of a like remote village's tradition. And, you know, although, you know, I named Sardinia, I could be naming any of the 20 regions in Italy. There are such a huge wealth of pasta shapes that like I'm really working hard to eat them all, but I'm not succeeding because there are too many.
And are these done by hand or are there special tools in the different villages to make the shapes?
Both. Yeah, some are hand-shaped completely, and others have, like, really special tools. And because Sardinians, like, historically have been really good at whatever the word is, smelting or working with iron. Is that a word?
Yeah.
Let's go with
it. You got it.
Yes, nailed it. So there's a great knife-making culture, and so there's also a great, like, pasta tool-making culture, and tools can be, like, highly specialized to the specific home cook, which is amazing.
That feels like another endeavor for later, like your pasta tool museum.
That would be a dream. Oh, my God. That's a great idea.
Okay, we'll do it.
Nice.
Great. And then just to round out your education, because you talked about your SOM certification, you also have an archaeological certificate from the city of Rome.
Yeah, so this is such a weird thing. It's a degree in archaeological speleology, aka spelunking. So I basically was trained to explore and map underground archaeological sites, everything from like Iron Age rock quarries to the grossest and most important place in Rome, the Cloaca Maxima, the city's functioning sewer, which is super gross. Like, I can't tell you how disgusting it is.
But you've been down there.
Yeah.
How many showers?
I mean, so many, and a lot of antiseptic was involved. And thankfully, a member of my class was like a surgeon. So he would, like, you know, wrap up all of our clothing and stuff, like our hermetically sealed suits to go down there.
And do you use the certificate for anything? Do they call you and be like, Katie, we need you to come take a look at something?
They don't call me to go map anything, but the organization that provides the certification is involved in some projects because, you know, there's just so much in Rome. And
Which projects?
So they've mapped the Cloaca Maxima, which is, like, shockingly, it's a sewer that's been used by Rome for 26 centuries, but until recently there was very little exploration of its origin, like where it started. We know where it ends, the Tiber. You can go visit the exit, though I would discourage you from doing so. But yeah, they get called in to, like, do things that really should be done by properly trained doctorate certified archaeologists, but, you know, it's Rome. Anything goes.
So you get to do it.
Yeah.
That is incredible. How long is that certification for?
That's like 4 months, probably not long enough.
Not to be trusted with that many centuries of history. We're going to take a quick musical break, and then we're going to talk about all things tour guide and educating people on Rome. We'll be right back here on Snacky Tunes.
You guys aren't fat.
Just means knowing nothing of where you've been or where you're going feels farther. You're a sight to see this early morning, getting lost in my own neighborhood. The same freedom you feel is what's been blowing in my cell since I arrived here. Slowly coming. The images are slowly finding out for once I know there's less to life, what's more is looking the for images me. Are slowly saying yes instead of no, not wondering what might come my the direction. The images are slowly won't be long, best just to gaze and daze and fall to dream something familiar. It's all, it's all, it's all or nothing. It's all, it's all, it's all or nothing.
You mentioned that you love micromanaging people's experiences, explorations. When did you go from collector of knowledge, deep curation, to being able to offer people tips in a way that wasn't just like, hey, I'm coming to essentially make a business out of it?
So I moved to Rome in 2003. And I think by 2005, a lot of the people that I'd either given tours to or who were like university classmates and were coming to visit were already reaching out to me for tips on where to go for like museums, how to tackle a Vatican, and I would always include a little bit of food. But I think my, you know, larger reach starts in 2009. That's when I start having my first bylines in newspapers, and that's when people who I don't know start reaching out to me and asking, where should I eat deep-fried artichokes? What's the best carbonara? And so because I was getting so many questions, I sort of built a number of guides like on my website, katieparla.com. And those, you know, would be shared and stuff. And so from there, I think things really sort of spiraled and now a lot of people reach out.
And what makes a good tour?
I think a good tour is a combination of the guide, reading the clients and seeing, you know, what their guests need. Looking after, you know, all of the interests that they have. Off-the-shelf tours, I think, are sort of the most common. And when you go to Rome, you'll see lots of people just, you know, guides that are just literally like regurgitating a script that they learned 40 years ago and have never updated. And I think, you know, that's like really upsetting because Rome, although it is a living museum, it's also this dynamic place that changes. And I think like good rapport between the guests and the guide is really important. And then a deep knowledge rooted in education on the guide's part, I think, is fundamental.
When people are visiting Rome, what are some of the things they get wrong and that they do to make a miserable experience?
So one thing people get wrong a lot is that they think you can't have a bad meal in Rome, and you absolutely can. And the way that they like guarantee that is by not making bookings in advance. And I know that like arranging every minute of your food schedule is like not a romantic thing to do. However, I often urge people to put that aside because if they go to quote unquote like the best places, they're supporting people that really need help, that are, you know, fantastic at fermenting dough, but maybe not great at communicating, that wouldn't otherwise have, you know, a robust clientele. So maybe leave a few things up in the air, but plan your gelato, plan your bakery stops, plan your pizza by the slice visits, and of course your trattorias.
Yes. When Darren planned out our Italy trip last year, it was, I want to say 3 months of work, but he might say it was longer. And he was very serious about making sure that everything was on there. And it was great. There was only one misstep. And it's when we went to like a new a new Italian place that was trying to, yeah, geez. And it was not very good.
There were foams, weren't there?
I don't remember what it was. It was just like things that did not need to be updated. It was sure. updated for the sake of updating it.
Yeah.
So that's one thing they get to, so it's like a bad meal. And then how about like mapping out their time or kind of, you know, trying to see it all, or what recommendations would you have for that?
I mean, I'm a really big advocate of skipping the Vatican and saving like 4 hours of your life and dedicating it instead to visiting like smaller venues that are run by people more respectful of the art and its conservation. So don't go to the Vatican, but if you want to see Raphael frescoes, go to the Villa Farnesina. Skip the Vatican. If you want to see Michelangelo works of art, go to St. Peter in Chains. Like there's so many excellent places where you can be one-on-one with masterpieces without like literally doing damage to the Vatican Museum collections by bringing your sweaty body into the buildings.
Fair enough. Truth spoken. And then as far as like, you know, exploring the rest of Italy, you know, I remember when I first made my first visit over to the other continent, they were like, I was like, yeah, I'm going to do like 9 countries in 6 days. And they're like typical American.
Yeah.
So what type of pace do you recommend for people, and what type of just kind of like mapping things out, but allowing things for relaxation?
Yeah. I mean, this is difficult because I know a lot of people never get to go to Italy full stop. And you know, the majority of others who do go once. So I understand the impulse to like, quote unquote, do everything. But I think that you miss the sort of atmosphere of Italy if you're doing like the trinity of Venice, Florence, and Rome, even taking 9 days to do it. Like that's too fast. So I would suggest like pick a city and then like get a rental car and full insurance coverage and go on a road trip through a region. Visit Bologna or Modena and then travel through the region. Go to Rome and then travel through Lazio. And that might not like check boxes, but I think that travel thankfully is moving away from that necessity to do too much, and that people are more interested in like having an experience that feels good rather than checking off a bunch of monuments from a list.
How have you seen that shift? Because in my mind, I think that people are just going like Instagram checkbox or completism. Mm-hmm. So like, what have you seen in this shift? And can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've seen over the past 5 years in particular, like a huge rise in tourism to secondary cities, to countryside destinations. People are doing, I mean, there's even like a term for it, like slow travel, which is borrowing from slow food. You know, regions that used to be off the radar, like Puglia and Calabria, are seeing a rise in visitors, which is really, really wonderful, because you can't say that you've been to Italy, really, if you haven't been to the Deep South.
Right.
That's my thesis.
When you're exploring a new city, because you don't just have Italian guides, you have guides to other things, where do you start?
I'm really exceptionally bad at planning. So, ironically, I help people plan, but I don't know how to do it myself. I usually give myself, like, build in a couple of extra days before I actually am researching something to get to know the place. And while I might survey some friends or chefs for, you know, where they would eat or where they would shop for ingredients, I also rely a lot on my, I don't know, like sixth sense, for lack of a better word. Like I run and I bike. So that like those ways of moving through cities lets me cover a pretty broad area and often pathways that most, you know, tourists wouldn't see. So that like that has led me to find like crazy like ricotta sellers or butchers or bakeries that wouldn't necessarily be on the radar even of locals unless they live in that particular neighborhood.
And when do you feel that you know a city enough to give tips and to be a guide? Like what gets on there where you're like, okay, I feel confident enough that I'm not just like a passerby or don't have like a couple good days, but I'm like guide status?
Yeah. Well, I think it's when I can walk around without opening Google Maps and like know the streets and take people, like if I can get myself around without having to like look at maps, then I feel comfortable taking people around. And I like, again, I'm like really good at very few things. One of them is memorizing dates. So if I've been to a church in Naples or Grignano or wherever, like I'm going to remember the details about that. So that's less, I probably spend less time like learning those details than other people and more time like actually getting a sense of, you know, the urbanism of a place and how it's been built and laid out.
Your cookbook, Tasting Rome, won one of the best awards in the culinary world, the 2017 IACP for Best International Cookbook. The recipes, because you've done so many, were selected based on stories.
Yeah.
Did the stories come first, or did you have the recipe and find stories around it? How did you pick those recipes?
That's a great question. I mean, I think like so many first-time cookbook authors, I had a huge list in my mind, but then I had to balance it with like the needs of like the visual aspect of the book. Like Rome's brown foods are the most delicious foods, so you like can't have all of the brown foods.
You could. You're not going to win any awards with it, but
yeah,
you could.
I'm gonna next book. Brown foods.
Oh, Rome. Yeah. I mean, you've already got the medal.
Totally.
So it's like, now you can just do whatever you want.
So, yeah. So like sort of balancing, like not having too many organs, not having too many artichokes, and just like getting that balance. So it was essentially like thinking of, these are the 150 recipes to choose from, and these are the ones that can actually fit within a book, which is very visual. And really sticking to things that people would make at home, with the exception of the oxtail tureen, which zero people have made and will make because it's like 1,000 steps, but it's a really cool story. But yeah, like I think the idea wasn't just to give people Roman recipes. There are already a zillion Roman recipe books, but instead to provide like a panorama of the city today and how people eat today and how that's changing and what they can expect if they visit.
And did you swap out any of the recipes because you found it was an okay recipe but a beautiful story and that made it in there? Or, like, how did you balance the two?
Like, are there recipes that aren't great? That aren't good?
Well, the dish is maybe not as the most popular, but the story behind it was exceptional.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, like, the nerve and cartilage salad was chosen because I like the idea that people used to boil, like, the shins and, like, toes or whatever you call, like, hooves. Right? That's a word?
Yes.
I struggle with English sometimes, sorry. And like knees of lambs and like get every last bit out of it. And I know that most people don't even have access to those things and probably aren't like hankering for chewy cartilage salad. But like I like the story and I think that the offal chapter would be missing something if that recipe wasn't in there.
Final question. What is Katie Parla's essential Rome day?
Okay, so you start with a maritozzo, a yeasted bun that's sliced open and filled with 2 cups of whipped cream, like something impossible, and a double espresso. Like one espresso has no effect on me. 2 barely do. Then you stroll, and by the way, you would get that either at Ragoli, which is in the Esquilino district, or Cafe Roscioli, which is closer to Campo dei Fiori. Then I hit the Trionfale market, which is my favorite produce market with like amazing fishmongers, all sorts of great butchers, drop my stuff at home, put it in the fridge or wherever it needs to be, and then head out for lunch. And I really am into like pizza a lot. So I would head back to the Trionfale district for pizzarium. So pizza by the slice, cooked in sheet pans, made by Gabriele Bonci. And I'd invite friends so I could have like 20 pieces instead of just like, you know, a couple slices, which would fill me up. Next, another coffee at... let's see, where would I go? Ooh, probably like Faro or one of the places, or Pergamino, that does like really exceptional espresso, which is unfortunately not the norm in Rome. They use very good beans. And then gelato at Otoleg in Trastevere. I'd go for a run after digesting. And then for dinner, I would hit Roscioli. So it's sort of like a bookended Roscioli day. And that's a salumeria. It's a wine bar / restaurant / deli. And I'd get burrata with semi-sun-dried tomatoes, mortadella with 36-month-age Parmesan shaved on top of it. Can you tell that I've thought about this perfect day? And probably gricia. So essentially a pasta that's like carbonara but without egg. So cured pork jowl, black pepper, pecorino romano. So delicious.
Dessert there too, or somewhere else for dessert?
I would probably have... They always bring like biscotti or these like little ciambelline al vino, these cookies to dip in chocolate sauce, and like I usually just have like that, and they do a really good cannolo, but really like I'm a gelato person. I'd probably go back to Otoleg. It's too good.
And then anywhere for a nightcap.
Yeah, I'd grab a cocktail at Litro or a Digestif. Like I tend not to drink, you know, heavy cocktails at night, but instead go for like Amaro or Grappa or some Aquavit or whatever. And so yeah, maybe Litro, because it's so close to home, and then I can crash and start it all over again.
Perfect. Katie, thank you for being on Snacky Tunes.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people find you, follow you, get your tips?
So I am at Katie Parla on Instagram and Twitter. My website is katieparla.com. My books are available wherever books are sold. And my website has tons of free resources, including things that I've written for a variety of publications, as well as purpose-written blog posts.
Perfect. We're going to take a quick musical break, play something from the archives, and then we'll be back with the second half of Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network.
I had 6 more weeks to go.
This program is brought to you by Jewel Sous Vide. My name is Katie Mosman-Wadler. I'm the executive director of HRN and a real-life Jewel user. I use Jewel to help me host the most delicious dinner parties. When you cook with Jewel, there's zero guesswork. So steak, chicken, seafood, turkey, vegetables, and eggs all come out exactly the way you like them. The Paired app is super intuitive and has a great visual doneness guide. Jewel is awesome for prepping many perfect portions, making it easy to cook for a crowd, and it's hands-free so you can focus on entertaining while Jewel does the work. And pro tip, Jewel is also great for travel. I throw mine in my suitcase if I'm headed to a rental house with any kind of uncertain kitchen. From perfect steak to juicy, tender Thanksgiving turkey, Jewel makes the best food you've ever tasted. Just be sure to save some room for mini jars of pumpkin pie. Jewel, perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Jewel and use code HRN, as in Heritage Radio Network, to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/JOULE, code HRN.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. In studio, we have Erica Spring returning for, I think, the fourth time.
Oh my gosh, really?
It's been four times.
We definitely did it once, just me before.
Yes, when your first EPT. That is Lauren, who is the newest addition to the Erica Spring Ensemble, and Kyle.
Hi.
My new solo project.
Who is?
It's a partner project.
It's a partner. It's like a family project.
It is.
This is a family show, so we're very into it. Erica, you were on Dinner with the Band with us.
Yes.
You did. You and Avar Simone did Snacky Tunes.
Go sit with Dad.
Don't say I didn't warn you.
No, it's great. We're gonna do this. This is where we're all going. I mean, all the musicians we know are either babies because they're all like in their early 20s, or they're having babies.
Babies themselves.
You were on Dinner with the Band with us.
So much fun.
So much fun. I still remember the amount of soy sauce they used to poach that egg.
Yeah, it was like black.
It was black. You did this show twice as Avar Simone, and then you did this when your first EP came out in 2012.
12, yeah.
Since then, you put out another record of Avar Simone. You did Nice as Fuck.
Yes.
And then you put out A Human.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, it seems like a long time ago.
I've been busy. I just really condensed like 6 years very, very quickly. How has the Last of Our Simone record, the Nice as Fuck project, and becoming a mother influenced your creative process? Before we get to the EP,
sure.
How has it just changed your approach to your craft?
Well, let's see. That's a really interesting like contrast between, you know, with Au Revoir Simone, we would usually take like a year to write and a year to record, and then Nice as Fuck happened in this whirlwind, and we wrote all of the songs, recorded, toured, did the whole thing like, you know, in under a year. So it was so fun to have that like really immersive, and the music too with that, it's like a punk band, you know, right. It's very much like mama singing piano.
Exactly.
So that, and then, yeah. And then the motherhood piece, a lot of these songs were started or written partially before Lauren was born, and then we finished them afterwards. So it was nice that with some of the writing process, I still had the pre-motherhood, like, extremely expansive time where I could just work on something for 8 hours or whatever. And then, that since he was born, it's all about, since Lauren was born, yeah. he's about to have his birthday. He's going to be two.
And since he was born, I mean, I know that you've spoken about being a night owl and working through the night. And even your bandmate Annie, I think, posts really amazing videos of finding time between motherhood and the creative process. Where have you fitted in, or how have you found the ability to continue to be creative? And have you become more efficient in it? Has it changed or like?
It's definitely changed a lot. And one of the huge things that like makes it possible is that Kyle is also, that my partner Kyle is also a musician and also has a flexible schedule, and we can trade off and help each other. And so, yeah, so I really feel for people who are like living on a super grid, because I can be more flexible and like, you know, find the time. But I used to feel like I was tired all the time. Haha. But
jokes on young Erica. You know nothing.
But I used to do a lot of work at night, and I would still do that, but it's almost like I physically can't. Like, I just don't have that. I get tired, and I don't have that brain, that focus place. I think I'm still kind of wired that way, because I still get like ideas a lot come at night. But I'm not able to do as much of like the work part.
And do you feel that the music that you're making has changed since you become a mother? The songs themselves, or the craft, or do you think that it's the same type of music that was always inside of you is still the same, it's just coming out at different hours of the day in different ways?
Well, it's interesting. This EP that I made with Homer, you know, we kind of initially, we were like just playing with synthesizers, and like particularly he had this synth called a Korg Poly 6 that used to belong to his dad, and it was one that I'd never played before, and I was like really excited about it, and that was like the sort of first seed of inspiration. But I kind of, he makes a lot of like groovy music, and I kind of thought that that was the direction, and I've always been into beats, I've always been into feel, like music that makes you feel like your body moving and stuff, and like dance music. And so I kind of thought initially that that might be the direction that we would go in, but it ended up being a lot more like soft and a lot more like spacious. So I think a lot of the songs I feel like were coming into our psychic space when we were writing, like when I was had like before I became a mother, but when that intention had been set, and I was like and it's a funny space to be in. Like, it's definitely, it's like, I don't know if you have anything like this in your life, but I know, like, I started noticing pregnant women. I started noticing kids. I just started, this, some different things, like, came into focus when I was, like, thinking about that being part of my life. And that, you know, that's just, like, one example, but there's, I feel like the process of becoming a parent for some people begins, like, a lot earlier than it. So I feel like it was already kind of floating around in that psychic space.
Can we hear a song?
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us first?
This song is the first song off the EP, and it's called Close to Here.
Great. Well, here we are, Erica Spring, back on Snacky Tunes, here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Thank you.
So you mentioned Homer was your co-writing partner. Homer was also on Dinner with the Band when he was with the Dap Kings.
Oh, no way.
And he used to have a food blog called Homer's Food Blog.
Yes, yeah. He talked about opening a donut shop sometime, too, while we were working, but hope that happens.
Yeah. Homer's Holes?
He loves food.
He really does. It was like a fun fact that when we did the show, it was like a little Chiron. Yeah. It was like, Homer's got a food blog. And then
actually didn't know that.
Yeah. Back in the early days of blogs when that was like talking point. Like, if I said I had a blog now, people would be like, I don't know what that means.
I know. I wonder if people, like, wear that badge proudly or what, you know, or what. It was a really good way of, like, connecting with other people.
Yes.
At the time.
Back when the internet was
have the discipline.
No. But he had one. He had enough where we talked about it.
That's so cool.
How did you connect with him to make the record?
I met him through his girlfriend, who is a good friend of mine, and we were just socially, you know, in the same social circle, and he really loved my first EP, and so he kind of reached out to me, like, let's do something together, and I was, like, nervous, because he has this, like, really beautiful studio, and I was just like, what does it mean to collaborate with a, you know, super pro, but it turns out it's just, like any collaboration, it's just about that human connection and like if you guys speak the same language or whatever, which we really did.
What is it? I mean, after 5 records and an EP and a decade plus of, you know, doing your own project, that still creates that nervousness. Like, how could you not come in there with a confidence or a clear idea?
I guess because any time anyone is facing something unknown, I mean, I think that's such an important part about being a creative person is to like stretch out and try things, but it's always you just don't know until you know.
And what was it in the process that, you know, working with him as opposed to Arval Simone and Nice as Fuck, mm-hmm. even on your previous EP, mm-hmm. that he brought to it? You mentioned live drumming, mm-hmm. and you know, talk about working with a live drummer, but also like what mm-hmm. was it, his approach that allowed you to expand or come at songs in a different way?
Yeah, I think, well, the most notable thing when I was sort of reflecting back at this project is that he, which I think has been kind of like poetic and symbolic about this time in my life too, is that he became a really amazing editor, and he encouraged me to, in the past I always had the tendency to like, you know, come up with ideas in the room and then like go home in privacy and make it perfect and then come back and like present whatever. So we weren't doing that. We were together trying stuff out, and I would like both on the keyboard and vocally, and then he would sort of have me do a bunch of takes, and then we would talk about it, and he would sort of like pull out or flag something. And which is interesting because it's actually really similar to how I work. I feel like I really enjoy doing like vocal production for other people, and I think that I have a similar ear in that I listen for something special. Like I listen for something, whatever, for something unique. But he was listening for something interesting, and then he would play stuff back for me, and it would often be something that I felt was like, oh, I was so uncomfortable in that moment, or I was doing something weird, or I was trying something weird, and so yeah, I thought that was cool that he was kind of selling me on my own mistakes, and that I loved them.
I love that concept.
Thank you.
And it's also someone who you don't have a history with, who like almost doesn't care, like almost doesn't, you know, doesn't have like the past history of like, well, on that third record, you let me get away with this, so I'm going to let you get away with this. It's like, no, this is all new, mm-hmm. and I'm going to make you mm-hmm. do different things because that's why you're with me.
Totally, yeah. And it was, and also just, I think also just having the, just that he was into it, whatever it was that I do, sometimes it's easier for you to see through someone else's eyes and be like, oh, they're telling me something about myself.
You mentioned earlier that you explored...
I'll go check because I'm not on the next thing.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
You mentioned earlier that Homer's dad had a synthesizer that you used and how it became like a backbone the record. How did you take this instrument that you had never really worked with before, and how did what grabbed it about you? What was influential about that particular synthesizer?
Well, there's actually a really there's an actual answer to that question, and a lot of it had to do with how staccato the sounds are on that synth. And most of my keyboards are more blendy. Like, the sounds are more blendy, so there's more sustain between sounds. And because this one was very staccato, I don't know if it's I think it might be like duophonic. I don't remember if it's, I think it's more than monophonic, but it created this like automatic minimalism because there's space between the notes. And so then the part kind of becomes, you know, a melody sounds so different depending what you're playing it on. And so, but when you're playing it on something really staccato, it's like very pronounced. So it's like, it's kind of out there. And then we just like let things be even more out there. Like, there's the song that I just did, the chorus is like a rainstorm. Like, we just didn't want to fill up all the empty space, and we just kept having that instinct.
Where, like, you used to, I'd say in some of your early works, like hide in like a dreamy sonic landscape, and there's layers and textures and
so many layers.
And this is just a bit more
less
out
layers.
There, more exposed.
Yes.
Can we hear another song?
Yes, yeah.
What are you gonna play for us?
This one is called Scars, and this is the one that the EP is named after. And this was just a really fun song. We were writing, and we were using a piano that day, and pianos just have that like emotionality to them, and this was just like one of those songs that just like just arrived and was sort of there fully formed. So
amazing.
The dream is awake and we know it.
Scars. Sorry. One of the things we've talked about for Scars was how it deals with you having a miscarriage early on, which is something that most people don't talk about,
mm-hmm.
and which is something that people just feel as maybe a singular or within the family. What was it that you feel, or how's the reception been since the EP has come out, mm-hmm. and being so open about it? What response have you gotten towards being so candid?
Actually, very little. I feel like it, but I have noticed so many people and friends lately, like, talking about their fertility journey on Instagram and just being so open. So I think it's like, it's definitely, you know, I think it's definitely a time where people feel like they can talk about stuff. And I think it's all, it's funny. It's like a little bit, it was, as I mentioned to you, and the song was written, yeah, it was like right out, I was trying to get pregnant for about 6, 7, 8 months, and I was also, it was when like Bernie Sanders was running, and I was volunteering on that campaign, and it was just like, it was just a time of very high highs and very low lows, and it was just a funny, like, looking back, it's just this like really poetic time. So I guess what's interesting about the public response or even conversations about it is that I feel like, to me, it doesn't feel like necessarily sad. It feels like just part of my life journey, and that's kind of how I feel about this song too. Is like it's emotional, but it's not sad.
I would be remiss to not ask about your time on Twin Peaks.
Uh-huh.
I know that I'm sure every single person in the entire world has peppered you with questions. So might I just ask, how was it? Was it as cool as it looked?
Sure,
and
yeah.
And you met David Lynch almost like a decade ago,
yeah,
too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had worked with him doing some live performances and collaborating with him in that way, but we'd never done anything on film. So when we got the email or whatever, it was really, really exciting, and it was so top secret, like, we couldn't talk about it to anybody. I kept being like, I'm in LA, but I can't tell you why. And it was so special. It was so special to be a part of something like, yeah, just that came around again, and that he got to revisit it as an artist, and then had such a huge, amazing response because there were so many new generations of people to be exposed to Twin Peaks and the original, you know, generation of people who liked it. So yeah, it was so much fun. We filmed it in LA, and it was on the same day as like many of the other bands filming it. So we had a couple of tries. It was just like lip syncing, so it was to recorded music and to some pretty old songs. So I actually had to like relearn them because they weren't songs we played live, and I wanted to look natural and look like I knew what I was doing on camera, and it was so fun. Yeah, just to hear David on the megaphone and, you know, directing us. It was really, really, really special.
What were some of the directions that he gave you or ways to look? Because it was out of context of the show.
Yeah, it was pretty minimal. He was more just directing, like, the whole room. Like, he was calling action and just, I think, the direction for us. He's always been, from day one, like, we were a very, very new band when we met, and we did a live performance while he was on a book tour for his book Catching the Big Fish, and we were such a young band, and at the end they opened up to questions from the audience to David, and then at one point the moderator asked us if we had any questions, and I remember I said, like, do you have any advice for us as young artists or something, and he just, without missing a beat, he was like, you guys just keep doing what you're doing, you know what you're doing, just like keep going. And I think that sort of was the same on the shoot. Like, he was just like really so much respect, which was a really good feeling.
Did he ever explain why he chose those songs out of your entire catalog?
No.
Did you get a chance to ask him?
Or no.
Were you like, oh, we don't want to ruffle any feathers. Yes.
I think people who really know our catalog would kind of get it. I feel like they're, I don't know. To me, like one of the songs that was on it is called Lark, and that was a song that I wrote, and it was a song that I wrote when I was 25, and it was a song that I wrote about, like, you know, just trying to figure it out, and like love, and just the, like, the heartstrings or whatever to a 25-year-old, and I feel like that relates to some of his topics that he, you know, or characters, or, you know.
Well, the other one was A Violent Yet Flammable World. That, when I heard it, I went, oh yes, like this relates to his entire universe.
Yeah.
Like this, it was, and I think it was the credits when that one played.
Yeah.
And I was like,
I think,
oh,
you're right. Yeah.
I was like, this makes sense.
Yes. Yeah.
I was like, oh, I was like, it almost, it was one of the things, like, and to be honest, I know your work, but I was not familiar with that song. And I thought it was a new one. I didn't realize it was such an old song. It was so perfect. You have to wonder if you heard that and just stored it away to have it.
No, it's really cool. They were both really old, and it was cool that he is such a, like, discerning listener that even, like, you know, at that time, the production was kind of, you know, like, the sound wasn't super amazing or whatever, but the song, like, the melodies and the songwriting spoke to him in some way.
And after it came out, and it's been a year now since it's come out, Annie was on when it had just come out.
Mm-hmm.
So a year later, did you get new fans? I mean, I know a lot of your friends were like, I was like on the couch, I went, holy shit, and I texted you. I was like, this is amazing.
It was really big. Yeah, it was really fun. And we definitely got a boost. Like, I send out the merch that people order on our website, and you know, it's died down at this point, but yeah, there was definitely an uptick, and we didn't have any more vinyl of that record. I mean, looking back, we had been, you know, on a break from that project, so we weren't really on it, but looking back, I'm like, oh, we really should have made some new vinyl of that album.
I mean, no one can ever predict those things.
Of course.
That's like one of those things. You never, or else it'd be like everyone watching, like, didn't care about the music, or who knew how it would be used.
Of course. Yeah.
It's only in hindsight. So the EP is out.
Yes.
What is, besides Motherhood?
Yeah.
What is next?
Well, I had a really fun time making my son's Halloween costume this year.
What is he?
He's a bird. Like, there's this book that we really like that has a bunch of birds in it. He's a blue jay.
Amazing.
But so it was just a little, like, note to self where I was like, oh yeah, I went to art school originally. Like, I really like making things with my hands, and, like, I need to have projects every once in a while. So that was just a fun thing to be like, okay, like, tactile creative expression is important. And then I'm actually, because I have, like, mixed feelings about live performance, I wasn't sure how much I wanted to play when the EP came out, but the two shows that I did do were so fun and so nourishing that I definitely want to keep doing it. So I'm hoping this winter and spring to do some more New York shows. I'm hoping to play in Mexico City, LA, and Nashville and Miami. That's my grand plan.
What's the mixed feelings?
Well, I think I really burned out on tour with Au Revoir Simone, and I felt like with this project and also having a young child, just feeling like, okay, I don't want to force myself to tour if that's not feeling like it resonates. And also, the music is, I wasn't sure, just what it would feel like to play these songs live, but it was actually really, really special. So I'm definitely want to keep playing shows and then, you know, keep writing. Songs are kind of like, I don't know, they just drift in sometimes. So I'm listening, and I'm still trying to work towards keeping making music in whatever capacity that is.
And also with all the changes in the emotions, especially with something like Scars, you have an outlet to put it somewhere where I feel like a lot of people maybe tell their partner or their friend or their therapist, and then mm-hmm. it just doesn't have, it just maybe one or two times, and you just have this incredible, mm-hmm. beautiful outlet to like
it's
express
true.
Yourself.
No, it's true. And I also do healing work. I do Reiki, and I get to be in like healing spaces a lot. And I really am fueled by just, you know, the bravery of like people working on themselves and just like not running from the journey of life, like really being present for it and trying to, if that makes sense.
It does. Well, we want to thank Katie Parla, who took time with us to speak when she was over here in New York. And Erica, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
What are you going to take us out with?
So this is a song from my last EP. This one is called Six More Weeks, and my husband Kyle is going to accompany me.
Amazing. Thank you for listening. We will be back next week with an all-new episode of Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio. Erica, please take us away.
No drums on this one. Let's roll.
Cool, let's do it.
I feel a little bit like too close to you.
Yeah.
I'm gonna just scoot over like here. Okay, that's better.
All right.
Can I come in that early? Is that fine?
Yeah.
Okay. If I had six more weeks to go, I'd be over that mountain. Thinking my way, I'm always thinking my way. When you left me all alone, without any warning, over and over we go. I've been leaving my lid on, darling, caught from love sick down to a new low. Nowhere in my imagination did I see where did I come in a little early?
Yes.
Yes, okay, sorry about that.
for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.